history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, they really are heroes around you. And often, we have no idea how they have directly or indirectly impacted the lives that we lead every day. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories, hold on to them so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And throughout that process, we are educated, we're very entertained, and so often we're inspired by the things that they did then and the lives they've led since. I think we'll be left with that kind of feeling today after spending the next hour with Dick Over, 92 years old, of Golden, Colorado. He's a member of multiple skiing halls of fame, but it all traces back to his time in the 10th Mountain Division during World War II. Dick has done quite a bit to trumpet the history of the 10th Mountain, even though he wasn't able to take part in the division's most famous exploits in the mountains of Italy during World War II. We're going to find out why his service took a different route, and we're also going to learn something I bet you haven't heard before. I don't think I had really understood with relation to the Rocky Mountain ski industry. This might blow your mind. I caught up with Dick in the beautiful home he and his wife Marge built on Lookout Mountain in Golden, Colorado. But we're going to take him back to his native Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And maybe this is a good motivator for the young people listening today, because, Dick, you never would have heard about this brand new idea of ski troopers if you hadn't been a really good student as a teenager.
What happened was in high school, I won a work-study scholarship put out by Westinghouse. They paid my tuition to go to school at night, and I worked in the research laboratories in the daytime.
Huh.
That's where I met this Dr. Trygve Jensen, a good Norwegian who was on the ski patrol. The ski area was Seven Springs, which is just 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh. We would go out and ski on weekends, and Dr. Jensen took me under his wing and got me interested in the National Ski Patrol. So I qualified for that at 17. I was kind of a junior patrolman. So I worked for Dr. Jensen in the labs, and I came in one morning, and he said, Dick, there's a paper on the corner of my desk. I want you to take it home, read it, give it to your dad. You sign it and get your dad to sign it. And I said, what is it? He said, it's your invitation to get into the mountain troops. And I said, what are the mountain troops? He says, they're skiers. He says, it's a brand new army outfit. You're qualified enough as a skier, and I think you'd enjoy it. Well, I thought about it, and I took the paper home, and my dad was in the Marine Corps in World War I, so I had a military background. My dad was not too strict, but I learned a lot about military life. So he reluctantly signed the papers. He wanted me to go into the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps had been very good to him. Even post-war, he had been able to qualify for a loan to get his first home and my first home. So anyway, he signed the papers, and I turned them in. And just before I was ready to leave, the draft caught up with me and said, you report for a medical. So I reported and passed the medical, and I told him, I said, I've enlisted in a thing called the Mountain Troops. He says, have you got any papers? And I said, they should be in the mail. He says, tough. So they put me on a troop train and sent me to Fort Meade, Maryland. The first thing they did at Fort Meade, Maryland, was they put me in a study carrel and put headphones on me. As in the scouting program, I had learned Morse code. Mm-hmm. And I passed that first carrel situation with Morse code with flying colors. And 2 days later, I was on a train to go to Camp Blanding in Florida to join a signal, big signal outfit that they were starting. First, I thought, going to Florida, that's not too bad. But when I got there, I was disappointed. Territory was hot, miserable sand, coral snakes, centipedes, and all kinds of things. And then the crowning thing was that the cadre for this signal outfit was from the south, from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And the cooks knew nothing but southern food. Collard greens, sweet potatoes, all kinds of southern food, which I was not used to and didn't care for. Well, 4 weeks of basic training, and I get called in one day for the first sergeant. Sonny said, there's papers on the corner of my desk. I've heard this before. And he said, they say you're to go to a Western camp. And he said, no, we'd like to keep you. You're going to be a good signalman. We'd like to keep you. But I have to give you the choice. He said, go to lunch and then come back and give me your decision. Well, go to lunch. That was the key to the whole thing. I thought, I can't do any worse going west than what I've got here.
You mean the food?
The food. The food was just, I didn't care for it. So I went back and I said to him, I've made my decision. I'm going to follow up on those orders that I signed to go to the to a mountain training unit. And he says, son, I'll give you one more chance. He said, I just came from a place there in Camp Carson in Colorado Springs. I know about that camp up there. He said it's full of Polish coal miners and mule skinners. They throw each other through plate glass windows on weekends for entertainment. Now, that's not the kind of a life for a young man like you. And I thought to myself, this guy really wants me to stay.
I guess so.
So I said, Sergeant, I'm going to follow up on my request. So he says, get your stuff in a duffel bag and throw it in a Jeep. Next thing I know, I was on a troop train headed west. And when I got into Colorado Springs and saw the mountains there, I thought, boy, this is where I want to be.
As a lifelong skier, yeah. And I bet, can you imagine how different your life would have been if you had stayed? You would have missed out on quite a bit, wouldn't you?
Yes, I sure would. That decision that I made to join what later became the 10th Mountain Division changed my whole life. I had wanted to be an engineer. I was studying engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. I was working in a laboratory. My whole life was pretty well centered on being an engineer. And when I got through with the 10th, I couldn't get back fast enough and make my change.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It changed my whole life.
I've got to ask you, as someone who is still skiing at age 92, how young were you when you started? When was the first time you got up on a pair of skis?
I was 10 years old. Somebody gave me a little pair of short skis, just almost as tall as I was. And I lived across the street from a very large cemetery, the largest cemetery in Pittsburgh. There were kids skiing and tobogganing and sled riding in that cemetery. So when people ask me today, where'd you learn to ski? I say, I learned in a graveyard. In those days, skiing was growing in the Midwest. The Norwegians and the Swedes and whatnot were building ski areas primarily with ski jumps.
Mm-hmm.
And on Saturday morning, we'd go to the movies and we would see the Pathé News, and we'd see these fellows skiing, ski jumping.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that looked kind of interesting, and that's what, at that time, there was no slalom. There was downhill racing, and so what we did in that cemetery, what we would do was find a tombstone just about maybe a foot high and pack snow around it, and then we would look up the hill to see where we could find a path down to that stone and hit it and jump. But the key to that whole thing, Paul, you're laughing. We'd look to see if there was an outrun with no more tombstones. And we would find those. And then in the summertime, we'd go along and we'd take pebbles and put it on those tombstones so that we could find them in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And we had ski runs down fairly steep hills in Pittsburgh. As we got better, we would find another tombstone that was higher, and we'd have that wet powder snow, or wet snow, and pile it up and make a jump out of it.
Uh-huh.
So we got pretty good at ski jumping.
I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who's ski jumped in a cemetery before, so there's a first time for everything.
Yeah. Well,
You mentioned your father being from the Marine Corps, the old breed, as they called them back
then. That's right.
Had he told you many stories from his Marine Corps experiences in World War One?
Yeah, he did. He was in the Philippines, and he was in France. He was there at the end of the war, and they kept the Marines on what he called cleanup duty. But he got to travel sometime, and my dad took a lot of pictures. He had a little folding Kodak camera, and he took a lot of pictures. He had three big photographic albums, and I had all of those, and I grew up with those pictures on my lap. And so I say I had a military legacy, and I was very proud of my dad. He was quite an athlete. He grew up in a little town outside of Pittsburgh called Kane, Pennsylvania. He became captain of the basketball team. He played tennis, and he played baseball. So we went into the Marine Corps with four or five of his buddies from that little surrounding area, and they stayed together. And after the war, they would all gather in the fall and go hunting together. So I grew up with that legacy, and I was very proud of my dad. He taught me to swim at the YMCA. During World War One, the YMCA was like the USO is today. When he came out, he joined the YMCA, and the first thing he did was teach myself and my brother to swim. He played basketball, became the captain of a basketball team for the YMCA, and they were so good. They played Duquesne University, Pittsburgh, Springfield, and some more, and just walloped the socks off of these college teams. These guys had lived together and played together, and so they had a camaraderie that I picked up, and I carried that on to this day, the camaraderie that we have. That's why I'm still doing things like this morning. I gave a talk. There were two of us who were still living and still skiing some. And it so happens that our birthdays are the same day,
how about
March
that?
22nd. Huh. He was born a little before me, and so he let it be known that to the group we talked to this morning that he was my elder. And he was older. He became a hero with a Silver Star. He personally attacked a German machine gun nest, threw a grenade, and killed the guys. And then he took the machine gun, and the other Germans that were coming, he killed a lot of them, and for that he got the Silver Star.
Wow, what's his name?
Hugh Evans.
And I'm sure there are a lot of 10th Mountain veterans that you could tell me some stories about, because you're so involved with them. Getting back to your father, and you saying, you know, that how much you looked up to him, and I get the sense that you always had a feeling you were going to be in the service at some point, one way or the other.
Yeah.
But what do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Everybody seems to remember something about that day.
I can tell you exactly where it was. My first job in high school, a friend of my dad's, was the manager of the largest theater in that area, and he gave me a job as an usher at that theater. On December 7th, I was an usher standing at the head of an aisle, the center aisle. There were big theater, had two big organs, 3,500 seats in that floor.
What was it called?
The Enright Theater.
The Enright Theater, all right.
And on December 7th, I was standing at the head of the aisle, and the chief of service came over and he said, "We've just been bombed in Pearl Harbor." They had the radio on.
Did you guys interrupt the film to make that announcement to the folks in the theater or no?
They did at the end of the film.
That had to be something to witness, to watch that big of a crowd react to that kind of news.
Well, this was a Sunday morning, and there weren't too many people in the theater on Sunday morning.
They're all at church.
Yeah. So that's my story about the beginning of the war.
Everybody has a December 7th story.
Yeah,
it's always
right.
Fascinating to hear. Yeah. And you've already shared with us how you enlisted and wanted to be in the mountain troops, ended up, we followed your path all the way back to where you actually were with these mountain troops. And this has never happened before in American history. You guys were real trailblazers. This is a first-time thing.
That's right.
Usually when that's the case, when you're doing something that no one else has done before, there are some curveballs or some hiccups or some mistakes that happen along the way. Do you remember anything like that?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you what resulted from I went through that early training. To be honest, I got a little bit sick and tired of being an infantryman. In my early days, I had joined the scouting movement, and the reason for it was my dad was in the Marine Corps. I grew up with a book that I still have. The Marine Corps had a thing, Blue Jackets Manual. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps was the fighting unit of the Navy. So that Blue Jackets Manual had a lot of Navy because they transported the Marines
right
wherever they needed them. So I grew up with a lot of interest in the naval things. My buddies were all building model airplanes, you know. I was building ship models.
Mm.
So I learned a lot about through that Blue Jackets Manual. And so I joined the Sea Scouts. For 3 summers. We went as a group to Chesapeake Bay and spent 10 days on a 3-masted schooner.
Wow.
So we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And with my interest in my dad and learning, I had originally thought maybe I'd be in the Navy until this mountain unit came up and I was a skier.
Right.
So I followed that path instead of going to the Navy. Well, I looked one Sunday when I was in the infantry. I looked down the way and I saw some vehicles running around with antennas on them. And they had just started a signal corps unit for the division.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked down to the signal company and I walked in and said to the lieutenant, I said, "Lieutenant, I learned a lot about Morse code and things like that. Are you recruiting for signalmen?" And he said, "Yeah, we're looking for radio operators." So he interviewed me a little bit. 3 days later, I was transferred from the infantry into the signal company. I got to be a driver of a radio vehicle, a military vehicle at that time, were Weasels. If you look over at this picture over here, you'll see me sitting in a sitting in a Weasel.
And I have that photo and quite a few others posted for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page as well as hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break now, but when we come back, we're going to follow the rest of Dick's World War II journey and learn about the impact of the 10th Mountain Division that has gone far beyond World War II and far beyond the military. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, learning a little bit about the 10th Mountain Division today and a lot about the unique journey of Dick Over, 92 years old, of Golden, Colorado. He's originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was the Army that first brought him to the Rocky Mountains, training at Camp Hale with the 10th Mountain Division during World War II. For photos and even a couple videos of Dick, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we left off, he told us how he was moved from the infantry section of the 10th Mountain to a signal company, and as such, he got to drive a vehicle called a Weasel, which would come in very handy during intense winter maneuvers there.
We went through winter maneuvers called D-Series, and that sounds for Division Series. It was right in the middle of winter, 30 below zero all the time, and it was tough. Fortunately, I was the driver of that Weasel, and I survived. I had an open port to the engine, and I stayed warm, and I could sleep in my sleeping bag in that Weasel at night. So
the other guys were in foxholes in the snow, or what?
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah,
big
yeah,
difference.
Yeah, big difference, yeah.
They're
not so much foxholes as mountain tents.
Okay.
During that time, right after the D-Series finished, the unit was prepared to go eventually overseas. And at that time, a bulletin came across from Washington asking for anyone in the military who had any maritime service to take an examination for a warrant officer's rating. Well, sitting next to me was a Norwegian, another Norwegian. I seem to be tied in with Norwegians like Dr. Jensen back in Pittsburgh. But this fellow said to me, he had been in the first officer on a Norwegian ship when Germany invaded Norway, and he sailed the ship right into New York. And they put him because he was a Norwegian, and Norway at that time had a small unit of Norwegian soldiers that were sent to Camp Hale. And they were to be our eyes and ears to go in and free Norway from the Germans. That was a big plan on the military. Eisenhower scrubbed that, saying that they had further plans to go into the main continent, and they could bypass Norway and starve them out. But they sent these Norwegians to a small unit to us to get us acquainted with what they had in their country. It was a small unit of about 50 Norwegian skiers. And anyway, this Bill Bisseth was one of them and sat next to me. And he says, Dick, this bulletin just came out. He says, why don't you apply for this warrant officer's rating? And I said, well, why don't you? He said, I've had my days at sea. He says, I'm happy just where I am here as a radio operator. And so I applied. At that time, the ranks were pretty well filled. I was just a corporal. It looked pretty good if I could take an examination for something higher. There were about 13 or 14 of us fellows that applied, and the headquarters were not about to let any of us out. They failed all of us. I mean, they weren't going to let anybody out, but they had to follow that order and give us some kind of an examination. Well, the captain that was, he might have owned a motorboat someplace. Maybe he knew the difference between the bow and the stern, but he sure didn't know anything else. So they flunked all of us. Off we go to Camp Swift in Texas to prepare us, where they were adding heavy weapons and some additional units, some small anti-aircraft units and whatnot, prepared to go overseas. We didn't know where, had no idea. I was sitting in the PX having a beer one night, and a fellow comes over and he says, Dick, didn't you apply for that warrant officer's rating? He says, I did. And I said, yeah, I did. And he said, we're in a different service command now, and there's five of us that are going to reapply at headquarters. Do you want to go with us? I said, I sure do. So all of us went down. They interviewed us briefly. Separately, they issued tickets, and we got on the railroad, and we all ended up at the port of embarkation in New Orleans. I had asked one of the fellows who was interviewed first, what do they ask you? What questions? And he said, well, they're looking for both engine room officers and deck officers. And I didn't know much about engine room stuff. And I remembered I had seen a diesel ferry boat at just a couple of blocks away. So I quickly went down and bought some tickets to ride the ferry, and I went aboard the ferry. First thing I did was go down the gangway to the engine room. And these guys looked at me, and they were busy working. He says, "Can we help you, son?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to think so." I said, "I'm going to take an examination tomorrow, and I don't know much about diesel engines. Can you tell me something?" "Yes," he said. I was in my Army uniform, and they were pretty good. So they told me a little bit about engines. I didn't know that a diesel engine, in order to start it, it started with compressed air. And so they told me, and they were grinding the valves, and they told me all kinds of things. And so the next day I went before this old sea captain, and he was a crusty old sea captain. You just looked at him and you knew he was. And he said, "Son, what are you, a deck officer or an engine room officer?" I said, I'm familiar with both. He says, "Oh, no. He says, "You're better on one. What are you better?" And I thought a minute. I said, "Well, they'd be better taking an examination as a deck officer." So he said, "All right. How many ropes on a ship?" Well, that's one of the first things I learned. I said, "Well, there are only 7 ropes on a ship. All the rest are called lines and hauls." And he looked at me, and he said, "Okay." He said, "You're in a pilot house." He says, "Can you box a compass?" "Yes, sir, I can box it 16 or 32 points. He says, "Make it easy." So I boxed the compass for him at 16 points. He said, "Do you know your navigation?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I've spent a little bit of time in Chesapeake Bay." He said, "You're leaving port. What are your color of your buoys?" And I said, "Red, red and white, checkerboard. They may have a bell on them. They may have a flashing light." He said, "All right, you're entering port. You've been to sea. What color are the buoys?" I said, "They're black. They're black and white. It could be the same thing, checkerboard." "And all right." He said, "I think you know something." He said, "Go back to your quarters and we'll cut orders for you." They sent me back to Camp Hale and got all 5 of us that had been accepted. And they took us and they said, "We're going to discharge you today from the Army. We're going to re-enlist you in the Army Transport Service." And he said, "Don't think you can get away once you're discharged. You're still up for 24 hours. You're still under the Army." And they were taking no chances with us. All 5 of us were sent by rail to Camp Beale in California, where they were assembling a large contingent of replacement officers going to Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. So we stayed there for 2 weeks. They put us on a train and sent us to Seattle, where they boarded us on a ship and headed for Alaska. And that was Christmas time. So we spent Christmas on the ship in a terrible storm. Ooh. A lot of us were seasick. So anyway, we got to there and took us, this whole shipment was to replace the officers who were already in the Alaskan department, who had been there for maybe a year's duty, and the Aleutian Islands. The Aleutian Islands was now in the process of being made into a series of bases. What had happened, the Japanese had first taken the island of Attu.
Right.
The Marines and the Army went in and took the Japanese out there. They had also moved down to the island of Kiska, 2 other islands away. They were building a miniature submarine base there, plus a small airstrip. And it was from that airstrip that they bombed Dutch Harbor. And when they bombed Dutch Harbor, Roosevelt said, "Get them the hell off of American soil." And so they said, "When the 10th Mountain Division is finished in Europe, we'll bring them out and we'll send them off to attack the island of Honshu." So we were sent out there to build bases. The only deep sea port was Seward, Alaska. I was put on a first mate of an ocean going tug, and we carried barge loads of road building machinery, steam shovels, rollers, earth moving equipment. They had no ports in the islands, and the only way they could get them in was put them on a barge. You towed the barge out from Seward to wherever they wanted to, one of the islands that they were going to build a base on, and we'd take those barges and get behind them or on side of them and run them right up on the beach. The guy behind me with another one would ride, pull it up and tie up to that thing. Pretty soon we had a dock and they could start to unload equipment and materials, and they built warehouses. I hauled barrels and barrels of aviation fuel and diesel fuel between Seward and several of the islands out there.
You know, there are a few points where your story turned, and you talked about some of them already, but you mentioned when you were in the infantry part of the 10th Mountain and when you made that shift to the Signal Corps, and then eventually you end up on ships, which one envisioned, I'm sure, at that point in the story. Yeah. I'm sure there are a lot of guys that you trained with at Camp Hale that went over to Italy and didn't come home.
Yeah, and that's the reason that I'm giving talks like I did this morning. Those fellas would want us to tell the legacy of the 10th, and that's what most of us, Hugh Evans that I was with this morning, and he was quite a hero, got the Silver Star for what he did. We're trying to keep that legacy alive. But in order to, and partly to do that, we came back and we were skiers. We've developed a ski industry. We are responsible, and there's no, it's partly pride. It's pride, two things, for what we did in World War II, our part of taking the Germans from Italy, then coming back and doing the thing that we had learned to do with ski and start Aspen, Steamboat Springs, Copper Mountain, Winter Park was already started. That's where I've been teaching. We started the ski industry. Colorado alone, this year, it's $5 billion business.
Wow. And when you say we started that, you mean 10th Mountain 10th troops Mount- who came home 10th, from the war?
Yes.
What was it before? Some of those places just, there were no there ski were no, runs
there
at
was
all.
No, there was no ski. There were a few skiers from Sweden and Norway had moved into Wisconsin and Minnesota and places and set up ski jumps in small areas. One fellow famous came to Steamboat Springs and started Howlson Hill. So we really take pride in the fact that we have been responsible. And then, of course, it grew on its own because it became a big sport. And a lot of our fellows came back and designed ski equipment. Bob Parker became the public relations man for Vail and did all kinds of public relations work to build Vail to what it is.
But basically what you're saying, so I understand, I want people to understand too, you're saying that, you know, in World War II, it was devastating. I mean, so many millions died around the globe and more than 400,000 Americans died. But without World War II, without the training that was necessary because combat was going to be taking place in these alpine areas, without all of that, this huge ski industry in Colorado wouldn't have developed, or at least not the way it did.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
I bet most people have no clue that that's the case.
Well, it's gradually. It's becoming aware.
And one thing in recent years that's really helped in that regard is the documentary Climb to Glory, produced by legendary skiing filmmaker Warren Miller. I have that movie, thanks to Dick, and I'm going to let you listen to the intro of that film right now, narrated at first by a famous Olympian.
My name is Jeremy Bloom. The sport of skiing has taken me around the world. From the Olympic Games to unknown peaks in Alaska. I can't imagine my life without a connection to the mountains. And much of what I've experienced, in fact, what all skiers and snowboarders have experienced, is owed to an unlikely group of men, a band of brothers who literally put skiing on the map. This is their story.
Sometimes to learn the greatest thing about the present, you gotta step back to the past.
In the mountains, in the woods, we take our chances with anyone.
It was different. Military skiing was entirely different than what I pictured it.
If you think of a mountaineer, you think of a character. You were with a group of people that had that tendency.
And there are some days, you know, it was so beautiful, so inviting. We just take off.
These guys were not only fun-loving, but man, they were tough.
We were there because we wanted to be there.
And I thought they were going to kill us all off.
Just keep your heads and remember your instructions.
But we paid a very, very severe price for the number of months we were in battle against the Germans. 1,000 were killed and 4,000 more were wounded. The greatest blessing that came out of the 10th for many of us was the great common love of the mountains. And it became the lives of most of us.
The grandeur of the mountains was, it just gradually seeped into my body, and I knew that this was something that I was going to enjoy for the rest of my life.
And that voice you heard at the end there, you probably recognize as the voice of Dick Over. He is featured heavily in that superb documentary, Climb to Glory. I have some information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com about that film. When we come back, we'll hear how Dick has been involved in preserving the history of the 10th Mountain Division in other ways. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
This February,
when the Messiah comes, Rome will be nothing.
Prepare to witness the miracle that changed the world forever.
The Nazarene city rise again after 3 days. We will lose peace and order if it's true.
Through the eyes of a non-believer. Risen, starring Joseph Fiennes.
The tomb is sealed. Guard it with your life.
The most important manhunt in history.
The body has vanished.
His tomb is empty.
Was just beginning.
No more lies. What happened to the body?
The ropes, they just exploded.
Risen.
Where else you go?
You tell me.
You're looking for something you'll never find.
Open your heart and see.
Risen. Rated PG-13. Maybe inappropriate for children under 13. Now playing. For tickets and showtimes, go to risen-movie.com.
Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Dick Over, 92-year-old veteran of the 10th Mountain Division. And yes, not only does he still ski, he still teaches others to ski. He also has a connection to a beautiful statue honoring the 10th Mountain Division. In fact, some of his World War II artifacts were used by the sculptor to make it an accurate depiction. If you go pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook, you're going to find photos from Dick's home, including a model of this statue on his table and a photo on the wall depicting the real deal, which is on display at Fort Drum in Watertown, New York, current home of the 10th Mountain Division. So what are we looking at here, Dick?
The old World War II soldier on the top, belaying on a rope, a new or current trooper on a rope. He's helping him up the cliff. Mm-hmm. I had a hand in this. I got a call from the head of the chapter in New York. That was a big chapter. And the fellow who headed it was the superintendent of schools for the whole state of New York.
And when you say chapter, you mean the 10th Mountain Division Association?
Yeah. A lot of our fellows came back and took responsible jobs. Bob Dole, we're personal friends. Mm-hmm. A lot of fellows came back, and I got to call Art Thompson. He said, Dick, some of the new 10ths are moving into Watertown to Camp Drum. And we think there ought to be a statue. There's a girl in Boulder, Colorado, who's a wonderful sculptress. We're collecting the money for this, and we can't come out there regularly and check. Would you be the responsible person to see that Susan Raymond is able to do things, and can you help her in some way? I said, I'd be delighted. I went to Boulder, and I say this in front of my wife sitting out. I fell in love with her. She's the sweetest, most wonderful lady. I said, Susan, anything that you need, I said, I can supply it. Right now, my car out there has my rucksack with my pitons, climbing pitons, my all of my stuff. And I took these and I gave her these. I didn't have an M1 rifle, so she went out, got one at one of the Army Air Force bases here. This is what she came up with. And there it is. It's 17 and a half feet tall. She came up with some models like this, and I was very fortunate to get this in bronze.
And I'll put a picture of that up on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. It does capture a lot of the different things that the 10th Mountain Troops did.
Yeah.
And you mentioned keeping that legacy alive. One of the ways you do that, besides going around and speaking, as you do so often, to tell the story of what it was the 10th Mountain did and individual stories of heroism, but you guys have a reunion every year, and one of the things you do is you personally ski down the mountain, right?
That's right.
How would you critique your own skills now on the on the slopes?
Well, over the years, I've developed to be a pretty fair skier. In the early days, we did race against each other, and you'll see a stack of, on the mantle there, plastic boxes with medals.
All from your ski races?
All from my ski racing. Uh-huh. A lot of them are against my buddies.
Uh-huh.
Some of them were not real proficient skiers.
So at this reunion, I'm sure every year the number of you 10th Mountain veterans that actually still ski down the hill gets lower and lower. How many of them now that can still get on the skis?
Very few. Very few.
How long are you going to keep doing that?
Paul, I don't know, but I'm going to keep at it. I've been teaching at Winter Park for 25 years.
And you say that in the present tense, not past tense. You're still doing that.
I'm skiing with a group of seniors called Ski Meisters. You have to be 55 years of age and older, and I gave up teaching young people. I taught young people for a while, and they raced past me, and then they got into snowboarding, and I said, that's enough for me. I don't cater to snowboarders, and there's another reason for that, too. Anyway, they're a wonderful group of seniors. We have limited the group to 300 people. We have 85 people on the waiting list to get in.
Wow. How often do you ski now?
I've got a problem. My wife is 94 and is losing her balance, and so I'm very responsible for her. And so I don't get up to ski as much as I want to. I've got a responsibility to take care of.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Number one. And you two have been married for 60 years.
Yeah.
What's your secret?
Well, I married well. She takes care of me, and she goes along with a lot of things. She did ski when we first got married.
Was there any part of your personal World War II story that we left off?
I was still on duty when they dropped the atomic bomb, and I can remember that day I was sitting in a cove and listening to the radio. Our radio on the ship had a big antenna, and I could pick up local stations from the West Coast, and I heard that they dropped the bomb, and I thought, oh boy, there's the end of the war. And that's what happened. They just disbanded everything, and I had enough points in a point system to get out of the service. So I got out and came back and tried to finish my education, college education, and get into another field.
And how'd you end up here in Colorado?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, and after I'd seen Colorado, I couldn't get back here fast enough. I didn't stay very long at home before I headed west. They took me back into the Westinghouse, into the laboratory. They had to give you your job back. Mm-hmm. And they took me back. I looked around, and I found that there were other places across the country, and I found a couple of places here. I've made a fair living and was able to design the house. We built it. I did the electrical work. I had been in the electrical field. My heating is in the ceiling. There's miles and miles of cable that I stapled up and then had a plaster come up. Uh-huh. And I've got 13 thermostats in the house.
Wow.
That I can shut off any other rooms that I don't use.
Yeah, that's golden.
Yeah.
No pun intended. I guess we are in golden, aren't we?
That's right.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for the way that you honor your fellow 10th Mountain veterans and continue to do so. Is there Anything else that you want to say about the 10th Mountain and what you see the legacy of that trailblazing outfit to be?
Paul, that's a real good question. As I mentioned before, I'm giving the talks and telling the story, as I know it, of the 10th. I'm doing it to honor those fellows very close. The 10th was a very, very close thing. We had that one great thing in common, skiing, and we had the war. A lot of our fellows that we were very close to died in the service, and we feel that a lot of us, I'm not the only one that's just giving these talks. Val Rios is another one. To honor those fellows who died, they would want us to tell the story, to keep that legacy alive. And I think we've done a pretty good job in the last 25 or 30 years. And we've certainly had a hand in developing the ski industry. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of our fellows came back. There are still, I just attended the biggest ski show in the country here in Denver. And there were several books put out, and they've still got pages of stories of the 10th. Mm-hmm. And so we've been fairly successful in keeping that story alive, and it's developed into a tremendous history.
Amen. And when you talk about so many who died, what I hear underneath it is the realization that you, without a couple twists of fate or a couple decisions you made, could have been part of that number, huh?
I could have been.
What are you most thankful for looking back?
The friendships that have lasted through my whole life. These friendships of these people that I'm with, as we kind of fade into the sunset, it becomes very strong. Some of the fellows who came back suffered wounds, and I don't think because of the type of war that we fought, that we had any of these post-war things that some of the fellows these days are coming up with.
PTSD?
PTSD.
Well, and if guys did suffer from it, there wasn't that diagnosis, and they didn't get all the help that they're getting now, that's for sure.
Right. That's right. It was a different time, a different war, a different generation, and the things that those generations, when we came back, we tended to spoil our children. We had been successful, and we wanted our children to have all of the things that we fought for.
Well, chief among those is freedom, the best gift you could give to all of us. And again, we thank you for that. I have some great links for you at hometownheroesradio.com, including a ceremony where Dick was presented with his old uniform from World War II, not to mention some of the national coverage of the 10th Mountain that he's been a part of. You can even link to some video of Dick skiing down the mountain, as he does every year at his division reunion. Special, special man. And we meet a lot of them on Hometown Heroes, don't we? That's the program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.